May. May's sitting on her bed in Kuala Lumpur. It's late afternoon. In Amsterdam, people are cycling, ordering pastries, unrolling blankets in the Vondelpark, rolling joints, feeding the small dogs that live on the houseboats, sitting outside coffee shops. The thought of all the people of Amsterdam leading their lives makes May feel inexplicably sad. Their lives are like little pains in her body. The thought of the man, Armand, makes her sad too. That's not a little pain. It beats away steadily, like a second heart. Is Armand his first or last name? May doesn't know. In the restaurant, when he'd recognized her, May had just stared at him. She couldn't do anything else. She was too shocked to move. The room faded out around her. Her pulse jumped violently in her head. The man started to smile. "It is you," he said. "What the hell are you doing here?" He put the menu down. He was about to walk over to May's table, where she was still sitting, staring, as if she couldn't move, or not unless he looked away. "Mr. Armand," the waiter said to him. "Wait one second," said the man, turning to him. And in the moment that the man turned to the waiter, May dropped all her remaining euros on the table, snatched up her bag, and, for the second time, fled. She thinks now about how his voice softened, so that his, "What the hell are you doing here?" sounded more like, "Welcome, I'm so happy you're here." She puts her head in her hands. There's no apparent reason why May should have run from this man. There's no apparent reason why she would delete her memory of him. Except, she did. It wasn't enough for her to leave Amsterdam and go back to London. She'd eradicated the knowledge of even having met him in the first place. There had to be a reason for a move as bold as that. "Are we based on memory?" May asked her mum once. She was starting her philosophy A-level and had been asked to hand in an essay about the ethics of stem cell research, screening of embryos, or memory removal. She'd chosen memory removal, reasoning that it ought to be a walk in the park. "Based," said May's mum. "Our personalities, I mean." "This is for school," May's mum asked her. She moved to May's shoulder to read the assignment. "You may wish to consider implications for the justice system, individual choice, philosophical standpoints, e.g. the argument that personality is based on memory." "Christ," said May's mum. "The persistence of Locke." "Locke? We've only done him for social contract theory," May said. "In short, Locke said that the self is based on memory," May's mum said, rolling her eyes. "Scientifically, nobody knows the extent to which our memory forms our idea of self and how much our idea of self forms our memory. In practice, it doesn't seem to matter. Long before Nepenthe came along, lots of people were living happy and productive lives with parts of their memory missing, even quite large parts. Our sense of self is very resourceful. Some people cope with the loss better than others, obviously." "Right," May said. "So the self could be based on memory, but some people just learn to get around without it, like a three-legged dog." "Three-legged dogs are as happy as any other dog," May's mum said.
"So what about the people who don't cope? That can't come to terms with their missing leg?"
"Coping is a choice," said May's mum.
"I personally would encourage those people to ditch Locke altogether. I mean, this whole idea that we're one story, one thing leading to another, talk about a rod for your own back. The happiest people are the ones who take the Humean view. Have you studied him yet?"
"No."
"So his view is?
The self as a bundle of processes,
a collection of associations, learned responses, memories, etc. Swirling, contradictory, inchoate, impermanent perceptions belonging to nothing. You tell your clients this?
I don't deal with clients these days, May's mum said. And if I did, no, of course I wouldn't.
Okay, May said.
Thanks.
This was fun, her mum said, putting her hand on May's. I'm always delighted to talk about your interests, Plum. Let me know if you get any other essays you want to discuss.
Will do, May said.
Alone, she felt suddenly miserable. She thought of her own missing leg, her months in the Chinese orphanage in Guangzhou. A phantom limb, still sending out its odd, hard-to-interpret signals. Shyness, anxiety, shots of pain. Her mum might have claimed that May wasn't a dog but a bundle of perceptions, but May wasn't sure that her mum really believed that. May thought that they'd both have been happier if May was a normal four-legged dog running around outside the remit of philosophy. Later, May phoned her dad. In your opinion, are our personalities based on memory? She asked.
That's your mother's area, May's dad said. Why are you asking me?
It's for an assignment.
Oh, very good, said her dad.
A presentation in favour of memory removals. Well, I take back whatever I may have said in the past about you not having a business mind. Very good, darling. I'd say your mother owes you dinner.
That's not, said May.
She stopped and sighed.
Never mind, she said.
In the end, May wrote about stem cell research. She was in favour of. She got a B. May picks up her phone. She searches for the Nepenthe Reddit. She doesn't really know why she spends so much time on this site, though her mum would probably have a theory about it. Reading about people who've had memories stolen or added or jumbled up. Most of the people seem pretty jumbled up themselves. Their most frequent complaint is that nobody is listening to them.
I'm listening, thinks May.
Not that the people on the Nepenthe Reddit know that. She scrolls down the most recent posts. User, Fight Illuminati. Topic, memory implants? User, a non-test subject. Topic, secret research program erased entire childhoods. User, hot mama. Topic, what they don't tell you about antidepressants and Nepenthe. Alarmed, May clicks on the last one, but it's just another theory about antidepressants being used as population control, and antipsychotics too. And for people who realise what's going on, people like Hot Mama, and stop taking their meds, the government have Nepenthe, the drug that's used to wipe memories. They put it in the water supply and remove the memories of the population en masse. Hot Mama has sent her own tap water off for testing and, surprise, surprise, the testing agency said they didn't screen for memory removal chemicals. Someone else says that the chairman of the Nepenthe board is a Tory donor. Its CFO used to have a high-level position in the Treasury.
They're not even attempting to hide the connections.
Isn't that just your standard Western government / corporation coziness, though? Says someone called JohnBoy82. I mean, why would the government wipe all our memories anyway? JohnBoy82 is told to wake up.
May closes the webpage. She imagines her mum overseeing a convoy of lorries filled with men in black wetsuits holding cases of memory loss drugs to tip into the water supply.
Do what has to be done, May's mum says, hands on hips.
May can actually kind of picture it. But she also pictures the day she left for Kuala Lumpur,
her mum dropping her at the airport, trying not to let May see her crying.
Is there anything else?
Yeah. There's a really obvious thing May can do that she really, really would rather not do. She can call her mum and ask her about the memory wipe. Is this absolutely, definitely, 100% the only option? This is what May is thinking, sitting on her own bed, the phone slippery in her hands. Is there maybe another way? No, there isn't. She wipes her hands on the duvet cover. She spins the light on her bedside table, a revolving thing she used to have when she was a kid, with birds that moved over the walls and ceiling when the light was on. It doesn't turn anymore, but she still finds something about it comforting. She doesn't know why she's so daunted by a woman who bought her a light with revolving birds on it to celebrate May's achievement of going 3 weeks without wetting the bed, and read her stories as the birds flew slowly round. She wipes her hands again and calls her mum. "Plum," says May's mum. "Where are you?"
"I'm at Dad's apartment," May says. "I just got back from Amsterdam."
"You just... what?" May's mum isn't ever lost for words. Under other circumstances, May might have enjoyed this moment, but she's sweating, the silence increasingly clammy, physically pressing on May to explain herself.
"I lied to you," May said.
She takes a breath.
"I know I had a memory of a trip to Amsterdam deleted. I was a night client, obviously. I didn't know about it until recently. But I had some traces, so I asked Katja, and she said we'd gone there on holiday, so I went back to find out what had happened."
"You what?"
"May, I don't even know where to begin," May's mum says. "Why didn't you tell me about any of this? You'd just have talked me out of it."
"Did it occur to you that I'd have talked you out of it because it was a terrible idea?" her mum says. She sounds angry. "There's a system for people who retain vestiges of the original memory. There's support."
"So traces do exist?"
"Of course they do. Nepenthe just hasn't admitted it yet."
"So what? You'd wipe the traces?"
"Wipe. I do hate that word," her mum says. She pauses. She sounds less angry now. Not shocked. Not anymore. That's a bad thing. May's mum, angry and shocked, might have said something unintentionally revealing. May's mum having had a moment to collect her thoughts is going to be impossible. "But yes, removing the traces is the best thing to do under the circumstances. What were they? What did you remember?" May winces.
"I don't want to tell you," she says.
"What? Why not?"
"Because they're mine," is what she wants to say.
"I just want you to tell me what happened on that holiday," she says instead. "I know you're not allowed to, but I need to know."
"I understand why you'd feel that way," says her mum. "And I know you must be feeling frustrated and confused."
"Don't therapize me," May says. "Can we just have an actual conversation like we're both adults? Not like you're my mother/psychologist and I'm your daughter/patient.
"Okay," her mum says. "But I'd like to point out that you're appealing to me as a mother. You want me to go against my professional code of conduct and tell you something that you agreed in a legally binding contract you did not want to know under any circumstances. It's only as a mother that I'd feel an emotional need to give you what you want. As a doctor, I'd tell you no." Okay then, stop being Dr. Louise Nightingale. Be my mother, May says.
I'm not going to stop being either of them, her mum says.
As your mother, I feel that what's best is for you to come back and remove these traces. As a professional, I know that's what's best.
She pauses, then says softly, but it seems like you don't trust me.
I don't know what I think, May says. I think, I wish you'd only ever been my mother. Not a doctor mother who prescribes me memory wipes, deletions, whatever, and antidepressants. I don't want...
But she started to cry, so she stops talking. I've lost, she thinks.
Plum, her mum says. I love you. What I care about is your happiness. Don't you know that?
I suppose, says May, wiping her nose.
I can't talk about the procedure you had, but I can say that I could never have prescribed it to you. Could never, would never. Maybe I've given you advice with your happiness in mind. And it's advice I gave a lot of thought to at the time and stand by now. I did support your having the procedure. I still think it was done for good reason. The decision to have the procedure, though, was yours alone.
May looks out at the skyscrapers of Kuala Lumpur, blurry in the fog. She came here to make a getaway. A bold move. What a joke. She thought she'd leave her mother's house in London and everything would be different. But she's still there. Every morning she wakes up in her bed in London, 7 years old, in wet sheets. She could dream about Amsterdam, maybe, but it's just a dream. She thinks, none of my decisions are mine alone. Not long after that, the message from Nepenthe arrives. It's November. May is walking through Crows Hill towards the clinic. It's only about 10 minutes from the station, which is good because it's cold. An edge of frost scrapes her throat as she breathes. The light is brighter than in Kuala Lumpur, less hazy. It's strange and familiar at the same time. She passes a tall clock tower, a Tudor pub with black beams and white plaster, a few old trees with benches around their trunks and autumn-coloured leaves, mobile phone shops genteelly tucked away below the arches of an old-style new building. May's mum used to live here years ago. She shared a house with some other medical students because it was close to St. Helier Hospital. Back then, obviously, there was no Nepenthe. May googled the town before she came. Its Wikipedia page said that Crows Hill used to be a dormitory town, or was, before the clinic arrived, and it woke up. May wonders where her mum lived, if May's walking now past her old house. She hasn't been able to ask her. The two of them haven't spoken since May told her mum that she understood her mum didn't want her to do this, but nonetheless, she actually said that. Nonetheless, she was definitely going to get the memory back. May's mum was shocked, again. May wondered at how she could have gone through the first years of her life without shocking her mother once, but now it seemed like a daily event. Look, May's mum said, eventually, once it had become apparent that she couldn't change May's mind. Plum, you came back from Amsterdam in a terrible state. You may not remember what happened on your holiday, but you know what happened after you got home. If you restore the memory, I'm afraid that you'll be back in that state. After you worked so hard to recover. I've seen it happen. A lot of the test subjects who underwent this procedure haven't done well. They fell back into the same kinds of problems you've had. Depression, addiction,
serious self-esteem issues. It's why I argued against making these procedures available. I'm still against it. And now, to think, my own daughter... She broke off. May was horrified to realize that her mother was crying. Her mum never cried. I'm sorry, May said. I'm sorry, her mum replied. I didn't want to tell you that. Aside from anything else, it's professional misconduct. But there's a greater good here, May, and if it helps you decide what the best course is, I don't regret it. Help, May thought. Decide. Best course. There was something wrong with the words. She thought about Armand in the restaurant. The jolt of the tilt of his head, his smile. She thought about a motionless rat, lying on its back, eyes closed, nose and whiskers pointed up to the sky. She called her mum back. I might not be like one of those people, she said. People? What people? Said her mother. The ones who fell back into their old behaviours, the ones who couldn't cope. Maybe I could cope. I'm not a teenager anymore. No, said her mum. Of course not. But you are only 21. And it's not about age either. It's about what you're equipped for. Equipped for? May said. She was starting to feel angry. You think I'm weak? Not weak, said her mum. Sensitive. You have a history of finding it hard to cope. Now who's constructing a narrative Lockean self for me? Said May. Don't be facetious, her mum said. I don't claim to know what the self is, but it's usually very predictable. So, predictably sensitive, May said. In my case. Which really means predictably weak, even if you won't admit it. Listen, her mum said, and now she sounded frustrated. There's nothing wrong with admitting vulnerability.
With allowing yourself to be helped.
Help, May cried. I'm sick of that word. If I need so much help, why haven't you helped me better? If you can cure my bedwetting and my eye and my addictions, why can't you cure this? Why am I not equipped for this? You're the doctor. You're always telling me that the self isn't a fixed quantity, so why haven't you made me into the kind of self that's equipped to know its own history?
It's not like that, May.
Isn't it? May said. So is it maybe that I am equipped? And that maybe you'd rather I wasn't? I wonder if I'd have been so vulnerable and depressed if you hadn't been reminding me all my life how vulnerable and depressed I am. You know, I thought I was the problem. Maybe you're the problem.
That's absolutely, May's mum began to say. May hung up on her. It was the first time in her life that she'd hung up on her mother. She was trembling. She realized she'd pulled all the sheets on her bed up around herself, plucking at them with her hands, tightening them. She kicked them away. Her mother called back immediately. May put the phone on silent. Her mum called again a few hours later. She left a voicemail saying that she respected May's wishes and she wouldn't keep calling her, but she hoped May would call back when she was ready to talk. Yeah. And you'll be ready with some counter-reverse psychology hypnosis voodoo routine, said May to the voicemail. I don't think so. She didn't call back. Recalling that last conversation with her mum now as she gets closer to the clinic probably wasn't the smartest thing to do. The anxiety of that argument collides with the anxiety of the impending procedure. She feels squashed. Slightly breathless between them. The past is painful. The future is frightening.
She wishes she could just keep walking up this hill forever, past the nice old houses, like that guy who had to roll the stone up a mountain, except in her case it wouldn't be a punishment, but a reprieve. But nobody answers her wish, and before she knows it, she's at the gates, and there's a confusing melee of people with camping chairs and thermos flasks, and banners saying, "Not in our name," and "Liars," and "Don't forget Jesus." May doesn't look at them. She walks straight through, up to the security guards. She shows them her passport, signs the logbook, stands still for a camera to scan her face.
"Don't do it!"
someone shouts behind her.
"Shut up,"
the security guard says to them.
"Sorry, Miss Lewarne. We get some Fruit Loops round here, as you can see. Now, if you'll please follow me to reception."
"It's the internet," May says. She laughs.
"Pardon?"
says the guard. "The internet, but in real life. I didn't really think about the internet people being real people, with thermoses."
"Real nuisances," says the guard.
He takes her through the clinic grounds, which are peaceful, with grass in wide, plush-looking stripes, neatly edged gravel and tall, dark pine trees. In the distance, a magpie is hopping across the bonnets of parked cars. Inside the clinic, which is white and futuristic, as she must once have noticed before, she's left to wait in reception. May looks around warily. She suspects that her mum is somewhere nearby, waiting to subdue May with study results and the power of suggestion. But after a while, she realizes that this is stupid. It doesn't make sense for May's mum to waylay her here. It would be totally unprofessional for a start. She could be sacked. For some reason, the realization that nobody is coming to stop her fills May with a sudden fright. She looks around again. There's a woman here now, standing near her.
"Hi, Miss Lewarne," says the woman. She puts out her hand.
May stands up and takes it. The woman has long, greying hair in a plait and a friendly face. An emissary of May's mother. She can't be sure.
"I'm Carini," says the woman. "Can I call you May?"
"Yes," May says.
"Lovely. Let me take you through to the treatment rooms and we can have a chat about the procedure."
May nods. She feels unexpectedly wobbly. Carini is walking slightly ahead, talking about what a bright day it is and has May seen much of the town and other things that are probably meant to be soothing and monotonous, and only when she gets May into the treatment room, sitting in a comfortable reclining chair, does she look at May's face and say, with surprise, "May, what's wrong?"
"I've hurt my mom," May says.
Does Carini know Louise is her mum? Probably not. May doesn't really care anyway.
"But she hurt me first."
Carini takes a pack of tissues out of her pocket and hands it to May.
"Go on," she says. "My dad texted me this morning," May says. "He just sent a smiley emoji. I don't know what that even means."
"Does he struggle with emotional communication generally?"
"Yes, but it's not that. He pretends to be really important and successful. He's like this freelance consultant in something financial, but..."
She stops herself. She can't exactly say to Carini, "My dad lives in an apartment that's paid for by my mum. Something he claims is just a tax thing he's helping her with, some way of avoiding tax, but actually it's more like she owns him, and he complains about her, but he's also too scared of her to give any kind of opinion on anything to do with memory removal, even when his daughter is about to, possibly ill-advisedly, possibly not, get a memory restored."
"He's just a coward," she says. "He still... Ugh. I was going to say he's still dependent on my mom, even though they divorced years ago. But now I'm thinking, I'm exactly the same as him. I resent my mum, but I live off her money. And the last time I spoke to her, I blamed her for all my problems. But I'm an adult now. I mean, I literally just said to her I was equipped to handle life without really believing that I was. But maybe I am, and I am responsible for my own problems. Though I am still angry with her. Yeah, I definitely am.
Okay, says Karini. It sounds, May, like you're having some really important realizations right now. Do you want to delay the restoration procedure? Normally we have this kind of talk afterwards, but we can delay the procedure and talk now. It's fine to do that. You don't have to have the procedure today either. I know the paperwork you got sounds very strict about cancelling and rescheduling, but I personally don't think that's a very helpful approach. So, you tell me what you need, May. Your well-being is the key thing. We're here to support you.
May laughs.
Sorry, she says. I'm not laughing at you. I just hear the words support and well-being so often that they don't sound like themselves to me. I think I need, like, a break from those words.
Fair enough, says Karini. Consider them obliterated from the English language for now. I mean, they're sort of therapy staples, but, well, it's good to be professionally challenged.
So, what would you like to do?
You don't have to have the procedure now, or ever, actually. It's completely up to you.
She smiles at May, and May feels suddenly better. She says, I want my memory back.
The actual restoring of the memory is nothing more than a nurse bringing in a tray holding a plastic cup half full of a bitter-tasting clear liquid, which May drinks, before Karini asks her some questions.
We'll start with the coffee shop, she says.
Armand's.
Have a think about it. See what comes up.
And May thinks.
May, Katya, and Sophia are sitting at one of the small tables outside Armand's. The late morning sun reflects off the canal. A small dog goes by, riding on the roof of a boat. They're all hungover. Katya is wearing a pair of pink reflective sunglasses and says that if she takes just one bite of the pastry in front of her, she's going to freaking vom. Sophia is silently getting through a large pile of frites with mayonnaise.
Have you seen the barista? Sophia says, when she's almost finished.
He's hot. I can tell he has a huge cock.
How do you know? May asks. He's wearing an apron.
Oh no, Sophia says, waving her fork. Looking at outlines, that's entry-level shit. I can work out how big a guy is just from his behaviour.
What, like having to sit differently? Katya asks.
No. Listen, according to my research, says Sophia, men who have big cocks are generally more chill. And those like attention-seeking, thirsty men usually have little ones.
Really? Says Katya flatly.
She tends to be unconvinced by other people's theories.
I'm telling you, says Sophia. So far, I've had a 100% successful prediction rate. It's a straight-up gift from God. I'm going to get that barista over here and prove shh.
Prove shh, says Katya.
She and May look at Sophia. Sophia is looking over Katya's shoulder. Katya and May turn round to see that the barista has arrived and has begun clearing the table next to them. A silence descends as he piles cups and plates onto his tray. He wipes the table, moves the little vase with one tulip in it back into the centre, and goes back inside.
"Do you think he heard us?"
hisses Katya.
"Probably not, but he totally saw you two spin round in your chairs and stare at him," says Sophia. "Though May here has already been staring at him like a 2-year-old looking at an ice cream or something. So you've basically ruined my chances."
May looks down, feeling self-conscious. May's mum once said that she wasn't sure Sophia and Katya had May's best interests at heart. May denied that. She felt defensive of her friends. Against what, she doesn't know. Just a vague sense. May once stayed out late with Katya and slept through a brunch date with her mum, and ever since then, whenever Katya's name is mentioned, Louise's eyes narrow. It's probably not even measurable, this narrowing. But May can see it. Anyway, now May's on holiday with her friends, she thinks her mum might maybe have had a point about best interests. "You're a major bitch on a hangover," Katya says to Sophia now. "Come on, let's get out of here. I need a Bloody Mary." It's the next day. It's 9 o'clock, and the other two girls are too hungover to even make it out of the Airbnb. May's walking alongside a canal in the already hot sunshine, feeling part of things. She feels an energy rising up from the cobbled streets and the tall houses and the brilliant water, moving through her and out again, out into the world. When May arrives at Armand's, this circling of enjoyment stops for a moment. She stands in the doorway, wondering what the hell she's up to. Then the guy from yesterday comes out of a door at the back of the cafe, carrying a sack of coffee beans. He puts them down, straightens up, and smiles at May. His smile is a thing of beauty.
"You were here yesterday, weren't you?" the guy says. "With your friends?"
"Yeah, they're still asleep," she says. "I thought I'd get breakfast."
She wants to ask if he overheard their conversation yesterday, but she doesn't have the nerve. Not yet.
"No problem. What can I get you?"
"One of those pastries, and a cappuccino, with a little jug of milk on the side, please."
He laughs.
"Why the extra milk? Would you prefer a latte?"
"Cappuccino isn't milky enough. Latte is too milky."
"Can I make a suggestion?" he asks.
There's something intimate in his raised eyebrows. May leans in. She knows he's only going to make a suggestion regarding the coffee she's ordering. But still.
"Have you tried a flat white?" he says.
"Never," says May. "But I'm on holiday. So, why not?"
"Walking on the wild side," the man says.
Does he mean to sound so warm? So, well, borderline flirtatious. Maybe he just has a warm face, like a bottlenose dolphin. They could be really pissed off or sad or bored, but their faces are still saying, "I like you."
"Did you, hear what we were talking about yesterday?" she asks the man.
He's turned away to make the coffee.
"Penises?"
he says, over his shoulder.
"Oh, right, you did. Sorry. "I didn't hear anything. That was just a guess. You're all females. You're in Amsterdam. You're worried I heard your conversation. Therefore, I deduced you were talking about penises. There's no need to apologize for that. They're a perfectly normal, everyday item."
He turns round as he says this. He's wearing a neutral expression. May has no idea what her own expression is. Probably not neutral. She wants to look around to see if anyone else in the cafe has heard this,
like the girl who works there and is right now only a few feet away toasting some sandwiches under a grill, but this would mark her out as even more unworldly. She laughs, embarrassed for being silly about penises. "Maybe to you," she says. The man acknowledges this with a genial shrug.
"Here's your flat white," he says. "I find it funny that as what, a Gen Z, a millennial, you've never had one of these before."
"Millennial. I'm not a very good one," May says. "Unless by millennial you mean 1,000 years old. Sometimes I feel like that." He laughs.
"Only young people say those kinds of things."
"You're not old either," she says. "You're a millennial too, technically."
"I reject that category," says the man.
"Well, you know what a flat white is," says May. "So?" The man laughs. She feels a rush of success. It urges her on to say, "Do you have a break coming up?"
"It's my cafe," the man says. "So yes, a break is a possibility."
"You're Armand?"
"I am. Pleased to meet you."
He holds out his hand for her to shake over the counter. The way he is looking at May makes her nervous and confident, light and steely, like an arrow flying right towards its target. "I'm May," she says. "So, when you finish, could I buy you a drink?"